Well, Genesis is a great place to start Bible study for the year, isn't it? It's the beginnings, and as we study it, we'll come to questions, more questions than we think than we are carrying into the study. And as when you come to Genesis, you most likely have got questions in your mind as to different things that need to be answered about the book of Genesis. But that's nothing to the questions Genesis is going to ask you if you'll but read it. For it asks very profound and difficult questions, like the first one on our outline. You'll notice our outline there, and inside there is the structure of what I'll be saying there. Now, the Genesis studies will ask us great profound questions like our first one, as to what am I? Now, see, that's a question that I don't normally ask very much. My five-year-old, she's 8-year-old now, daughter is being asked that at school at the moment. She's doing a series of projects on who am I and what am I. And so we've had to dig out family photographs, and we've had to get records of how heavy she was when she was born, and which hospital, and what were her first words, and all those kinds of things, so as to build up for her teacher and for herself some sense of who she is and what she is. But apart from third-class primary school, we don't often ask such a question as to what am I, who am I. And yet many of the ways, the decisions I make about life come from the answers to that question. It's because of what I think I am that I do the things that I do, that I think are appropriate to do. It's what I think I am which will determine whether I think life has got a meaning and a purpose or not, and if it has got a purpose, what that purpose may be. So they're very important questions to actually put to our minds and to seek answers for, because they're answers that we're going to live upon. You see, how do I understand myself? How will I can talk to myself, I'm an Australian. There's an identification of what am I, and that's why I have got the ukka-okka beer gut and all the rest of it. So that explains lots about me. I'll hold it in for a minute. Or I'm a university student, and that is why I do the kinds of things I do. Drink coffee and sit around yabbing on for nothing. See? Or I identify myself in a family. See, I'm the son of Arthur Jensen and Dorothy Jensen, and I've got two brothers, and I've got a wife, and I've got three children, and I can identify myself in terms of this network of related people. Or I can talk about myself in terms of my achievements, all the successes I've had and all the successes I haven't had, and I can describe myself in my failures and my achievements, or I can do it in terms of my physical attributes. You know, I'm roughly 6 foot tall, and I have about 13.5 stone, I've got eyes of such and such a colour, and striking good looks, and all this kind of thing, that I can identify myself as that is what I am. Or I can do it in a biological categories, can't I? And I can get out the fancy Latin terms for describes humans and of the male, and then I can Caucasian, white, I can get that whole kind of description of a thing I am. There's all kinds of ways in which I can answer that question, and as I answer the question differently, so I come to different implications as to how I'm then to live and what I'm to do. Now, Genesis answers those questions for us. But because we're not used to asking the questions, we very often are not used to hearing the answers. And when we hear the answers, we very often don't understand that the answer has been given. As we read Genesis 1, just as it's been read to us now, and we say, oh yeah, well, I've heard that. In fact, it's pretty hard to concentrate as it's being read, isn't it? You say, I know that. Yes, it's like reading the Christmas story. I know that one. I've got that down pat. And we do not realise the significance of what is being said until we see the alternatives, until we start to hear what other people think as to what I am and what is life and where are the beginnings and so on. Once we look at the alternatives, then we start to grasp the significance of what is being said here. And so in today's study, points 2 and 3, the chaos to habitation and the leading themes, we'll be looking at Genesis itself. But notice point 4 on the right-hand side, we'll come towards the end of the study, that's about the alternatives. And the reason I'm going to spend some time talking about the alternatives to Genesis 1 is because when we see them, then we will start to grasp the enormous significance of what is being said in Genesis 1. So we'll need to spend a little time looking later at the alternatives. The other day I saw a man down outside Barker Street, just at the gates there, and he was leading some small children across the road, and there he was, young fellow, bald as could be. Obviously had shaved his head, because down the back there was this tuft of hair all neatly plaited. Now, what he thinks he is something fundamentally completely different to what I think I am. And that is reflected in our lifestyle, even down to the way in which we get our barber to do his thing. Outside on the library lawn, people are selling vegetarian food at dirt cheap prices. Food that has been dedicated to a particular god whom they believe has now blessed that food so that anybody who eats it will come under his influence and power. See, what they think they're doing and what the customers think they're doing are completely different things, aren't they? Completely different things. What they think about food and what it is and gods and what happens. What you think is the world is like affects the way in which you live. And we need to understand the alternatives to grasp what is being said here in Genesis. Well, one of the key ways of getting Genesis straight is to turn to the Bible text that we've written up on the verse up there. Isaiah 45:18 is really in some ways a meditation on Genesis 1. It really captures what Genesis 1 is about. To demonstrate I can still do it, let me read it for you. For this is what the Lord says, he who created the heavens, he is God. He who fashioned and made the earth, he founded it. He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. He says, I am the Lord, and there is no other. That text really captures what Genesis 1 is saying, that God has created the world in a purposeful fashion, in order that it be not empty, but be inhabited. Or the word empty could be not chaotic, not futile, not void, not empty. And that is what is said in verse 2 of Genesis 1. The earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. God created in the beginning, but in the beginning he created a world that was empty and formless. But his purpose was not to create something that was like that, but to create something that was to be inhabited. And so verses 3 to 31 of Genesis, or through to chapter 2, verse 3, the rest of the chapter 1 of Genesis tells you how God has teased out that formless creation into a habitable environment and how he places the first inhabitants into that created order. How he moves the world from chaos to habitation is what Genesis 1 is about. See, verse 1 tells you that he's created the heavens and the earth. He's created everything. This is not, in a sense, a description of the creation so much as a description of the next step, that is, the creation into habitation, into an inhabitable place. That is what Genesis 1 continues to tell you. He creates it all, empty and formless, and then teases it out. And most of the chapter deals with this structuring of the universe from the initial formless, empty state into its final habitation by man and God's rest on the seventh day. And this orderly structuring of the universe is mirrored and reflected in the orderly structuring of the chapter itself. Now, it's a great battlefield today as to what kind of category you drop this chapter into. Some people will say it's history, others will say it's scientific, others will say it's mythological, some will say it's parable, some will say it's poetry. And depending which little box you care to put it in will determine how you interpret it to some extent. Now, I'm not going to enter into that controversy particularly. I'm sorry if that frustrates you, but I think there's great problems in entering into that. I want to point out this much, that the chapter is highly ordered and structured, and so much so that the content of what it is saying is reflected in the form in which it is said. It's talking about the way that God has ordered and structured this world, and it does so in a very ordered and structured fashion. So ordered and structured that you get this repetition of phrases going through the chapter. And God said, let there be, and there was, and God saw, and it was good, and God called it, and there was evening, and there was morning, X day. And that kind of pattern comes in each of the sections, doesn't it? So much so, so ordered, so structured it is, that once read, never forgotten. It's almost impossible to read this chapter to an audience a second time and for them to keep their interest. Your mind can't sit there and just take it in. You find it boring. You say, I love that chapter, but it's so boring when people read it. Because as it reads through, you say, yeah, I know that. And all I'm doing is just ticking off day three, day four, day five. I mean, how far has he got so far is about where my mind runs. Because the thing is so beautifully simple, so highly ordered and structured, that you can grasp it, and you can even grasp its orderliness in a first hearing. But yet it's not just repetition. It actually is an upward spiral. It really is moving somewhere, isn't it? it moves in this ascending order from the vast things that are created down to the specific things that are created, from the, in a sense, the simple things down to the most complex of things. It moves in an order that comes to the climax with the creation of man himself. And at that point, God then rests from his labour. But man, created in God's image, is the great pinnacle and climax of the chapter. So, in verse 26, we see a breaking of the repetition, a breaking of the pattern. From verse 26, God consults, we're not told with whom, other than himself. Trinitarians have no trouble as to whom he's consulting with, others have got great difficulties. God said, let us make man in our image. Nothing else is made in God's image. Nothing else brings about that kind of consultation with God. Everything else God just says. But now he comes to man and there's a pause while God decides to create this particular part of the whole universe in the image of God himself. And man is created, and after that, God rests in chapter 2 and blesses the seventh day as his special holy day, as God's day, the best day of the week. The chapter then is about this movement from chaos to the final habitation of the world. The leading themes of the chapter, as you come through it though, are about God and creation and man. They are the leading topics, if you like, of this chapter. God dominates it. He's referred to some 35 times in about 30 verses. He is the subject of almost every verb in the chapter. God is the centre focus of the whole thing. It's all about God creating. What is said about God here? Well, firstly, he's the creator of everything. In calling him the creator of everything, I mean, he's the maker of it. More than just the fashioner of it, he is the one who brings it into being. Isaiah in chapter 66 says that God, quoting God, says, heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. Has not my hand made all these things? And so they came into being. The potter may fashion the clay, but God does more than that. He makes the clay as well as fashioning it. He has brought the world into existence and fashioned it in the habitable format that he wishes it to be in. He is the creator of everything. That's captured in verse 1. The heavens and the earth. There's nothing else. Everything there is, he made. There's nothing outside his creation. There's nothing too big for him to make. He put the sun in its place, the moon in its place, the stars in their place. There's nothing too small, down to all of the little creatures. He makes everything. There's nothing outside, nothing too big, nothing too small. He is the creator of all that there is. Secondly, he creates with purpose. It's not accidental. He is actually making something purposefully. And you can see how it fulfills his purpose in this constant refrain, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. In what sense is it good? What does good mean? It satisfies the Creator's purpose and intention for it. You find it in verse 4, 10, 12, 18, and I gave up quoting them then. Verse 31 says it all, doesn't it? God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. It all satisfies God's purpose. And you see his purposiveness in the way in which he creates it all by his word. He made it all intentionally. It's not a mindless divine accident. It's not just that he was lying asleep one day and something fell off on his hand. It's not that he was cutting the spuds in the kitchen and nicked the top finger off and that turned into the earth. It's not one of those kinds of mythological descriptions that we find in the ancient world with certain variations than my particular myths. It's not just like that. It's not that the gods were having a fight and here was something left over from the fracas. It's not that. God purposely, intentionally, by word of his mind, he spoke and the worlds came into existence. But it's more than that. Not only does the creation by the word point to his purposefulness, but also points to his power. You see, if I dig a ditch, then I do it by a shovel. I get out in the sweat of my brow and I dig a ditch. If Mr. Rand digs a ditch, he does it by ringing up the Department of Main Roads and saying, I want a ditch over there, please, and somebody else goes out with a shovel. That is because Mr. Rand is more powerful than I am in the ditch digging area of life. I wouldn't say in every area of life, but in the ditch digging area, he knows much more about mud and slinging it around than I do. Now, No, that can't be right, can it? And so, because of his mighty power, he only has to speak and it's put into operation. God creates the world by speaking. He says and it happens. That is the nature of, and the idea of God creating by his word is an idea of power and purpose. It's his divine intention that he puts powerfully into effect. Of course, when we come to the New Testament, we find that Jesus is his word by whom he has created the world. But that's another story. The second great leading theme you have is that of creation itself. Certain things are said about the nature of the world. For example, the world is contingent upon God. I understand there are some engineers here, so let me explain it. Contingent means dependent upon, to rely upon. It means not self-sufficient. Your sitting is contingent upon the strength of those chairs. Right? If the chairs are not sufficiently strong, you won't sit there long. Right? You'll be in another posture. The idea of contingency is the idea that it's not self-sufficient. It is depending on others, or on something else, or someone else. Now the world, and the universe, and every part of it is not self-sufficient. It is contingent upon God. It comes into existence because of God. He made it. He brought it into being. Like many of the things we've said in Genesis, you say, yeah, okay, yeah, so. Well, in a few minutes I'll show you the alternative and you'll realise that is an incredible thing that is being said. So hang on. Next one is that it's habitable. That the world is created in an orderly and habitable fashion. Again, it's something we take into assumption. We just take by assumption. We assume that the sun will rise tomorrow. We assume that what happens physically will happen again and again. We assume it so much that we say there are laws of nature and we've built a whole technology and civilization and scientific inquiry on the orderliness of nature, that it just keeps doing it the same way all the time. But most of the civilizations of the world have not been built upon that. They have not thought that is the way. There's that marvelous civilization that believed in burning virgins before dawn each day so as to remind the gods to raise the sun up again. I always thought that was a great encouragement to sexual immorality among young girls as a way of keeping yourself alive. But you see, their whole sense of the world was the sun doesn't come unless the gods are appeased. For the gods that are involved with the sun, they may fall asleep on the job. There is the whole spring festivals and rites of different cultures that were aimed again to get the gods to work again so that they would send the warmth and the rains for spring so that the crops would grow again. Because you can't just assume that it will happen again and again and again, because it's not orderly like that. It's a chaotic, terrifying world that many people live in. But God created it as an orderly system. He's created as a place for people to live in. It's habitable. That's a key theme about the nature of creation, which we take for granted in our civilization, because our civilization is built upon it. Very important one to grasp hold of, the orderly nature, the habitable nature of this world. Third thing to notice about this creation is that it's good. Everything in it fulfills God's purpose. This again is an unusual thing for religious people to believe. Most religions of the world think the world is evil. Is illusory, is bad, is a seduction of the evil one or whatever it may be in its different forms. But the Bible says that the world, the physical universe, is good. It satisfies and fulfills God's purposes and standards. More of it again in a moment. The third area is man. And within this chapter, much is said about the creation of man in that he comes as the climax. Notice firstly that man is part of creation. That man is created together with everything else. That is, that man is contingent. He is not self-sufficient. That is, man is not eternal. Plato believed man was eternal, or at least the soul of man was eternal. But the Bible says, no, there was a time when man was not. That man has actually been brought into being. We are not eternal. We are part of creation, sharing the same nature, the same status as the sun, the moon, the waters, the animals, the insects, the cockroaches, and all the rest. We are the same as they are. Created by God, dependent and contingent upon him. But, notice also, we are unique in creation. For of all the created universe, we only are created in the image of God. To mankind alone is given the rule of the world. This unique status of mankind is essential to understand if we're going to understand what the rest of the Bible is on about. Now there are two things then, you see, said about mankind that are very important to grasp. One is, he is created. The other is, he's unique. You've got to grasp both those things. If you don't think he's created, if you think he's self-sufficient and always been and eternal and the rest, then you are tempted to make him into God. Or at least a rival for God. For he's not dependent, his existence doesn't depend upon God. He is independent of God. And if you do not think man is unique, if you think he's just the same as everything else in the universe, then you are tempted to do the reverse. That is to deify the cockroach. That hasn't happened much in our society yet, although I did see an interesting TV movie the other night, I turned it off after a little while, which said that the insects were going to take over the world. And it was a serious documentary. I mean, it must be serious. It was on the ABC. But we certainly see it when people put up signs saying whaling is murder. For the distinction between, the moral distinction between killing whales and killing humans is now gone, isn't it? When you say that killing a whale is murder. And there are people, you see, who do believe that it is. That there is no distinction. There's a man, Peter Spooner, down in Melbourne University, who wrote a book on speciesism. You've heard of racism and you've heard of sexism. He's against speciesism. That we have no right as a human species to actually use other species, especially for food. So he's moved to vegetarianism and insists upon it. Mind you, why we should be attacking the vegetables, I'm not quite sure, although there's a little paragraph or two he's got on trying to explain that one away. You lose the uniqueness of man once you lose this image of God idea. Two things are said about him: created, dependent upon God, and unique within that creation. But what does it mean to be in the image of God? Is it that God has physical appearance, like I have a physical appearance? Well, the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that. They believe that Jesus is literally sitting on God's right hand. If God should turn it over and pinch, then Jesus would rise. They believe he is physically there like that, right? That God is like that. But the Bible seems to me to say that God is spirit, and Jesus is the image of the invisible God. So it's not that. Well, then what is it? We tend to think it's well, we've got minds, great minds, bigger minds than whales. And therefore, that's what makes us like God. But it's a difference of quantity rather than quality, it seems to me. And anyway, that's an arrogance of people who have got too many brains to know what to do with their time. No, it's more likely to think it's got to do with our moral superiority. We've got a sense of responsibility. But what does the chapter say? It seems to me the chapter in verses 26 to 28 is really saying that the key to the image of God is the sense that we are the rulers of the world. God is the ruler of the world. The owner and maker of it, it is his world. And he puts one part of creation in this world, namely humanity, male and female, he puts this one part to be the lords of creation in his stead. The vicegerents of creation, the rulers of creation. And we image him in that we are rulers as he is the ruler. So I read verse 26. God said, let us make man in our image and our likeness and let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, etc. See the close connection that runs with that, and it does again down in verse 28. The idea that we are to rule. Now, if to rule we have to have a bigger brain, if to rule we have to have a moral responsibility, well, that may be so, and that's why we've been created in the particular way in which we have. But the essence of the image lies in our place in creation, it seems to me. However, you might say, well, look, I don't like that very much because ruling means that means we can rip it off and plunder and destroy. But that is not to understand God. For the way in which God rules is not the way in which sinful man rules. You see, chapter 1 of Genesis is one of the few chapters of the Bible that's not about sin. Sin's not in sight here. We don't get that until we turn the pages in a couple of weeks' time. Sin's not here. We're talking about man who is sinless ruling the world. And he was to rule the world as God rules the world. Now, how does God rule the world? By looking after it and caring for it. The way in which God rules is by service. And when the New Testament talks about people ruling, it talks about it in terms of service. So Jesus, remember, discussing with the disciples, who is the greatest? He says, the greatest is the least. The first is the last. If you're going to be great, you're not to be like the pagans. They rule it over each other and exercise authority over each other. But not so amongst you, because the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. The way of godly rule is by looking after and serving and caring for. And man is put in the garden, and man is rather put in the world, he'll be in the garden next week, in the world, as the one who rules as God rules over the world. Well then, there are the leading themes that I want to say about Genesis. Like I said, as you hear them go through, you say, yes, yes, yes. In fact, all I've said has been fairly uncontroversial to this stage. The subject of what is in the image of God, that's an area in which commentators will disagree. But otherwise, I think you'll find all commentators from all kinds of different shades of opinion will say that so far, very little has been said other than what's obviously there in front of them. It's not particularly radical in my views of Genesis 1 at that point. But to just feel like saying, yeah, okay, well, I get all that, is to miss the incredible things that have just been said. So let's look at the alternatives to kind of grasp how significant they are. One of my problems in looking at the alternatives is, what alternative did the author have in mind? Was he conscious of any alternatives? And I'd say to you that he undoubtedly was. It seems to be a tract of his time written against certain alternatives, but I have a difficulty of not knowing precisely which ones he had in mind. Let me illustrate. I know these ones he'll have in mind. Astrology. That's in mind when he writes this one. Astrology, because astrology was almost universal in the ancient world. Everybody in the ancient world had to some extent the idea that the planetary systems, the stars, the moon, the sun, were gods or contained gods or were symbols of gods who controlled your destiny and fate. It was almost universal belief. Now, what does Genesis 1 say about astrology? Well, it basically says, a loud raspberry. I won't make the noise, we're taping it. And you'd have to look at my... Well, that is basically... verse 14 following is about astrology, isn't it? It says that the sun, the moon, the stars are all put there by God. In other words, the God we're dealing with here is greater than any of those. That's first up, isn't it? And they're all put there for what reason? To mark out the time. To tell you, before the age of the quartz digital clocks, what day of the month it was, and what month of the year, and what time of the day. They've all been put there as markers, so that you might know the time. They're a clock for humanity. Now, that is the exact reverse of astrology, isn't it? See, astrology sees that those things control me. That they are my rulers and makers and... Right? Whereas what is being said here is, no, they're servants of yours. They've just been put up there by God so as to tell you what time of day it is. Now, to you and I, who are not particularly given to astrology, I hope, to you and I, we read down verse 14, we say, oh, isn't that quaint, he put the stars up there, okay. But to the astrologists of the ancient world, what is being said here is deeply offensive. Because it says your gods are not gods at all. Right? Likewise, polytheism. Polytheism was almost universal in the ancient world. So it's hard to believe that this man was not writing against polytheism when he writes. Because what does he say to polytheism? He says there is one God who has made it all. There's not the God of the sun, the God of the moon, the God of the trees, the God of the rivers, the God of this, the God of that, the all kinds of... He says there's one that's made the lot of them. And by the way, folks, he happens to be our God. Right? I'm sure there's a certain degree of rudeness involved in that. The one God who makes everybody. The God of Israel is not the God of Israel only. He's the God of the Egyptians. In fact, he made Egypt. In fact, he made the Nile. The one God has made everything. This is an anti-polytheistic tract, just as it is an anti-astrological tract, deeply insulting to the contemporary world. Now, there are many other things that I can know of the ancient world that he might have been writing against, but I can't be sure. For example, in Mesopotamia, the seventh day was considered to be a very bad luck day. It wasn't universally like that, but it was in Mesopotamia. Was this man writing against the Mesopotamian culture? Because the seventh day was a day of bad luck, and the 49th day of the month, because they were working on lunar months, etc., the 49th day after the new moon was considered to be the day of wrath of the gods. Now, we've got a little bit of superstition in our community called the Friday the 13th. And it's a bit of a plaything and people don't take it very seriously. Some people do who are superstitious, but an ancient world where people were indeed deeply superstitious, where there was great fear and terror of forces of a supernatural nature, the seventh day, and every seventh day, was a day in which it's better not to do business, it's better not to go out of the house, and the 49th day was a day in which you stayed in terror. But what does Genesis say? No, the seventh day is the best day of the week. That's the holiday. That's God's special blessed day. That's the day in which you're supposed to rest from your labour and enjoy yourself. Did he have the Mesopotamian belief in his mind when he wrote it? I don't know. I don't see how you can know. You'll never know that. But certainly, the thing speaks against all kinds of alternative views of how the world is, what the world is. Now, the ones I wanted to pick up on today, particularly, were the ones of materialism and mysticism, because they're very current in our world. Materialism wasn't very current in the ancient one, but that doesn't matter to me, even though it's not in his consciousness, most likely, I would think. We can still see it as being ruled out by Genesis 1. On the back of the outline, you'll see some of the definitions that I am using. They're just straight out of my head, not out of the dictionary. That's just the way in which I use the words, for better or for worse. I'm making them up my own way. What's materialism? Well, as I define it there, materialism is the eternal, shouldn't be external, eternal existence of matter. And usually the non-existence of anything else. Now, of course, matter could be all kinds of forms, couldn't it? I mean, it depends on your fashion. There was an ancient Greek philosopher, Thales. He believed everything was water. If you got it all back down to its constituent part, it was all water. Whereas I think some of us might actually be a little bit more sophisticated than that, and we might want to say it's, what's the latest fashion? You tell me later on. But, you know, atomic particles or energy particles or whatever you want to call it, it's still water. It's still the idea that you want to get back to say that matter is what has always existed. And that is fundamentally what the whole thing is. That, in fact, totally what the whole thing is. There is nothing else but material existence. That material existence has been worked out into different shapes and forms and patterns, but it really is still the same stuff. It's still the same atomic structure, just differently patterned. And so when you come to ask the materialist, what am I? The answer is your matter. That's what you are. Your matter that has been particularly worked out into the form of humanity, into a particular biological system. But you are still the same as you always. It's just matter in a particular configuration. That is what I am. Well, now, if that is what I am, matter arranged in this particular fashion, what values are there in the world? And what values do I have? And the answer is, there are no values in the world. And you don't have any value. Not if that's all you are, if that's all there is. Then their values are a nonsense. See, why are you here? You're here because 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 you're here. That's why you're here, because you're here. See, there's no rhyme or reason. No one put you here. You just happened. You're just a happening, an occasion, an occurrence of life. To ask what is the purpose and point of life is a nonsense. There is no purpose. There is no point. You just are here. You're an accident. Here's a book by a man, Jacques Monod. Interesting book, a French biochemist who won the Nobel Peace Prize. Let me read from the creased dust jacket here. It's a good summary of the point he is making, and it's a very readable book, even for the non-scientists amongst us. In essence, he says, all living things, including man, are the result of a purely accidental and unpredictable biochemical situation. In short, man is an accident, based on chance, and the accident is perpetuated by the necessity of chemical reactions. That's what we are. Hey, there is the materialist, thoroughgoing materialist. He's dead now, he knows better. He is a man who wants to say that an accident happened way back in time somewhere which produced a certain chemical relationship which involved a reproduction. And that reproduction keeps on going. And so there's a necessity about it, but it's just chance over time. And you are. That's what you are. Now, if that's all you are, if you are just an accident, what is the point of you? Well, accidents don't have a point. What is the purpose? There is no purpose. They're just happening. I mean, what is the purpose of this? Now, I can give it a purpose because I own it now. The maker can give it a purpose because he can make it for a certain function. But the thing itself is just a thing. It of itself has no purpose. It can sit there for millions of years, I suppose, except for decomposition. It can just sit there, but it won't do a thing, will it? It's got no purpose. It's got no point. It just exists. Well, that's what we are. We're just a matter. You say, well, what about truth? What about justice? What about love? What about romance? What about mercy? What about kindness? What about goodness? They're all fickle imagination of your disordered grey matter. That's all it is, you see, because all your thoughts are just your mind twitching, just your matter twitching. That's all that your thoughts are. And if your thoughts twitch, if your grey matter twitches in such a fashion as to make you think that there is a thing called truth, well, that just shows how disordered your grey matter is. Because there isn't such a thing as truth, there just is existence, that's all. If you think there is such a thing as love, well, it's really totally disordered. See, that is why you are no better than the chair you're sitting on, in fact worse, because the chair doesn't think that it's a person. It's not disordered like you are. Because you, see, what values you have? What's the purpose? What is the lifestyle of such a person who believes that really? Well, the lifestyle must be just self-centered interest. It's the acquisition of pleasurable sensations for my matter. That is the lifestyle in the end. The consumerism of the Western world really is materialism in both senses. Materialism in terms of its greedy consumerism, but it's materialism because it comes out of the belief there's nothing else but pleasure-seeking. Let me show you another type, mysticism. It's very different, it's very broad. It covers things from Plato to Hinduism to the monastics and to Christian Science. The whole idea of mysticism is that the other world is the real one and the physical world is not the real one. The physical world sometimes doesn't exist, like the Christian Scientists don't believe it exists. It's not here. Those reading rooms, the Christian Science reading, they don't exist. Don't worry about them. Because nothing exists, you see. Material existence is nowhere. Right? That's all a figment. Some believe it is here, but believe it is an illusion to draw you away from the spiritual reality. The idea of mysticism all the time is that the other is the real, and this is in some sense less than satisfactory, evil, non-existent. And so what you've got to do in materialism is find who you are in terms of your spiritual part, your soul bit, not your body bit. Your body bit doesn't matter. It's your soul bit that matters. Now, what are the values of them? Well, I mean, it varies enormously because there's so many different kinds of mysticism that are available. Let me think mainly in terms of Hare Krishnaism, because that's around and you've seen it around. That's a classic form of mysticism. They perceive that the physical world is maya, is illusion, meant to deceive you so as to stop chasing after spiritual reality. And so what you've got to do in Hare Krishnaism is to subjugate your physical body, to hold it in check and all its pleasures, because every pleasure, every physical pleasure, is part of the great trick to deceive you into thinking that you physically exist and that that's the best way of existence. And so you mustn't enjoy yourself physically within Krishna movement and Krishna consciousness. And so you get yourself into doing the chanting and the trances so as to lift your spirit out of your body by the monotonous 4, 5, 6 hours of chanting back and forward the name of Krishna. So you reduce the number of hours sleep you need, the amount of food you need, so that you only eat certain kinds of food, that do not have living soul in, namely vegetables. And even they have living souls in, so you have to get specially blessed from Krishna to avoid eating other living things. You move to vegetarianism as a pattern of life. So the whole lifestyle, you remove all physical beauty. That's why the bald heads and the baggy clothing. It's to remove physical beauty because you mustn't find another person attractive to you. You mustn't enjoy the sight. That would be, you see, to take your mind off the spiritual reality. You mustn't even enjoy sex. See, sex is only for procreation. The only times you ever have sex is in order to have a child. And even when you're doing it then, you mustn't enjoy it. That bit I've always found difficult to believe. The whole thing, you see, the whole lifestyle is so radically different. But yet mysticism is abroad in our community, isn't it? Transcendental meditation, all kinds of different martial arts, all kinds of different vegetarian, religious vegetarianism that you find in different health shops. Mysticism of all its different brands and varieties, becoming very much the vogue in reaction to materialism. The Western man, sick of the gluttony of consumerism, is turning aside to what he thinks is spiritual, that is, anti-physical, anti-bodily. And so he's trying to move into a whole religious systems that involve terrible bondage as a lifestyle. That is, people are trying, says the Bible in, say, Romans chapter 1, to remove the Creator. Because if you have a Creator, then he owns you. Then he's the one who makes the rules and tells you what your purpose and point in life is. And people do not like the idea of a Creator who owns me, who made me. And so what we're trying to do now is say, all right, I'll live without him. They do not realize that when you remove God, you also remove man. You do away with God, you do away with man being a distinct part of creation, created in his image. The materialist and the mystic reduces man down to terrible bondages, bondage to pointlessness and futility and aimlessness and valuelessness, bondage down into religious bondage of temples and shrines, of mysticism and of control of the bodily appetites, bondage that dehumanizes you. The book here is the ultimate Brahmin Hindu man. This man, this man's father, the guru's father, was a man who came to the final Hindu state of blessedness, or so it was thought. In his early 30s he died, but previous to that, for 8 years he had sat on one spot without saying a word to anybody. He was fed, he was washed, he was clothed by other people. He was in a semi-conscious state for 8 years. And he was worshipped as the man who had finally become God. That is the ultimate end of mysticism. Total dehumanization. His son becomes a Christian and exposes it in a most interesting book. The implications of the doctrine of creation are enormous. When we come to chapter 2, we'll see them in terms of work and marriage. We come to chapter 3, we'll see them in terms of our relationship with God and sin. We come to chapter 4, we'll see them in our relationship to each other. The implications are now going to be spelled out in the succeeding weeks, and I look forward to sharing them with you. Can I remind you of the white card? Let's pray, shall we? We thank you, Father, for your word, and we do pray that you would help us to understand it and its implications, that we might live in fellowship with you. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.